All right, here we are, and we have with us Evan Smith, the man in charge at the Texas Tribune, formerly at the Venerable Texas Monthly as well. And Evan, I don't want to get into our main topic of conversation before congratulating you on the outstanding year that the Tribune has apparently had. I saw the numbers that were released. I guess they ran in Adweek and several other places, and you all have done great. So. Yeah.
Well, thanks. I guess it ties directly into this conversation because Governor Perry has been a great tool of fundraising for us. we'll miss him when he's gone. The presidential race has been a big boon to us. And let me say back to you that the Texas Public Policy Foundation has been at the center of much of the conversation about conservative ideology in the governor's campaign. So it's been salad days for us both.
And, well, it certainly has. But what shall we do now that he's out? Rick Perry is back in Texas and has become a Texas concern once more. I want to get your take on this, but let me start. Yeah. I have something for the Blogging Heads audience here. I don't know if you can see me or not. Can you? Do you have me on screen?
I cannot see you, but let's just pretend that you're right there next to me. So.
All right. Well, so you can't see what I'm holding up here, but I have here with me a signed Rick Perry placard from the Red State Gathering on August 13th, when he actually announced his run for the presidency, and I was there in Charleston, and he announced his run, and of course Charleston is also where the campaign died yesterday morning.
It is
actually so
started in South Carolina, ended in South Carolina. There's a certain symmetry to that. I suspect you could probably get like $5 for that on eBay if things get tough over a TPPF, and you've got a fundraise. You can probably auction off that placard. The reality is that that $5 is about all the money associated with the Perry campaign that's left. I gather they just spent every last dime there by the end. Is that what you're hearing too?
Unless you have non-public sources, that's what I've read, that the coffers are more or less. I think Jay Root wrote something on it yesterday, if I recall correctly. But
he did. Could you have imagined any of our previous conversations for Blogging Heads that we'd find ourselves here at the midpoint in January, not even really at the end of January, the Perry campaign is over, he's heading back, and this race is proceeding without him? I mean, it's almost as stunning as the idea of Newt Gingrich being in the lead and potentially able to dethrone Romney.
Well, I think that's why we've been asked back, actually, because you and I have a horrific track record of assuring Blogging Heads viewers that Rick Perry will pull it out. We've seen it before in Texas, and if only we understood just how canny and savvy he is, and that he's not a quitter, and this and that, and here we are. It's January 20th, the day before South Carolina. He's endorsed Newt Gingrich. He's gone. In the worst case scenarios that I've gamed out with folks here in the conservative movement in Texas, we all assumed that even if it was a loss, it would drag on till March, at worst. And so this is a shocking outcome. And so I'm curious, Evan, to start with you, what do you think of the top contributors to his defeat? I mean, if you had to pick three reasons that he's out of the race, what are they in your view?
Well, understanding that it's dangerous when talking about the Perry campaign ever to ask for a list of three, I will give you a list of three. I think the biggest reason that Perry lost the campaign was Perry. I think that he just underperformed. He whiffed at the ball. Fill in the blank on your description of it. The reality is that he just didn't do it. He didn't do a good job at really any aspect of this campaign. I mean, he had his moments. He had his flashes of the Perry we know back here in Texas. But, he made a ton of unforced errors along the way, not just in debates, although those were the most visible, in his, retail politicking of the various early primary states. And we knew him to be a great retail politician, Josh, all these years.
Indeed.
He said the most extraordinary things, some of which were just factually incorrect, some of which were ludicrous, some of which were unnecessarily incendiary, many of which had elements of all three. He just did a bad job on this. And we knew him previously, as we've said many times, to be a terrific politician, 9 races run, 9 races won, no record of stumbles or mistakes really in previous races, and this was just a terrible misstep for him from start to finish. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, and I hate to diss these people because some of them are my friends and your friends, but it seems as if his staff didn't serve him terribly well. in preparing him for debates or for the rigors of a national campaign compared to running for governor of Texas. We know that Texas is a big stage, and he may have and they may have thought that by running for governor of Texas all these years, he was prepared to run to be president of all 50 states, not just governor of Texas, but he wasn't. And to some degree, poor staffing contributed to this. I think the third thing that contributed to this is that the Republican Party right now is a little schizophrenic about what it wants. While the Tea Party has risen to a much greater ascendancy than we've ever seen before in its influence on the outcome of elections and policy discussions and what have you, there is still a real war going on in the party. And I think that Perry was not able to figure out how to unite the two sides of the party, the establishment wing and the insurgent wing. And I think what we're seeing now in the Romney to Gingrich race is to some degree a manifestation of that as well. But Perry, in the final analysis, was as much a victim of that civil war, left on the battlefield, as anything. And I think that is not something that was his fault, but I think you play the hand you're dealt, and in that case, one of the cards he was dealt in that hand was he was running to be the leader of a party that was not united but divided, and that created additional obstacles for him. Do you have That's a list really of three yourself?
No, I have a list of two actually. Okay. I think again, and you know, I want to keep my list as simple as possible, and I can remember two fairly easily. My first one, I'll just express agreement with you on the organizational aspect of it. The campaign and Politico's story, which was leaked by apparently a disgruntled staffer or two a couple of weeks back, which I'm sure you saw, struck me as a fairly accurate description of what was going on inside the organization. It wasn't an organization that ever seemed to quite find itself, and so as a consequence, you had a tremendously accomplished, to my mind, governor of a major state who's done very well in campaigns and governance, although opinions vary on that. But I think he's done quite well. And the organization never quite lived up to the man. And so that's one. I concur with you on that. The other thing that I think got him, though, let me preface this by saying that I think that the underperformance meme, the debate gaffes, the foot and mouth moments, you know, Turkey being led by a terrorist government, which has a kernel of truth in it, by the by. I think that's a bit overplayed, and I'll tell you, you know, we are a nation that elected George W. Bush twice, and I worked for the guy, so you know, I don't say that with any disparagement, but you know, I think this mattered more to those of us in the policy and media spheres than maybe it did to the American people at large. The thing that I think got him on a substantive level, more than anything else, and actually deflated his credibility. I was looking at the very lovely graph of Perry's popularity that you folks at the Trib put up yesterday, and I can only assume that like a pre-written obituary, you'd had it ready to launch on the day of a withdrawal, because it seemed like a lot of work went into it. But when you looked at the rise and fall of Rick Perry in the polls and in the poll averages, the precipitous fall, the definitive fall for him, came at the debate where he had the infamous no heart line about illegal immigrants and the in-state tuition that's available to them at Texas State University systems. And substantively, and talking with a lot of people further to my right on this issue, in any case, I was really struck at the damage that was done by that. So I think it's important as we assess what went wrong, and of course, I guess Ray Sullivan yesterday was opening up the door to him possibly running in 2016, if that's an option. It wasn't all aesthetics, I guess, is what I'm getting at. There was an organizational component that you touched on, but there was also a substantive component too, is that he was I guess, out of step with what the conservative base considers a red line on what apparently is a more important issue than jobs, which is a little bit shocking, but so be it, and it's immigration. And I think if that's one positive upshot of the Perry candidacy, is that we've learned a lot about what the conservative movement is and values in 2012. And look, if you told me a year ago, 2 years ago, if you told me on Election Day in 2010 that the conservative movement would be fine with a guy with a mixed job creation record and arguably created the template for Obamacare, I would have been shocked. But here we are, so be it. Now we've got to move forward with the final four, Newt, Mitt, Ron Paul and Rick Santorum. And I guess that leads me to my next question. I mean, what do you think of this field? Is it the crew? I mean, everybody expected Mitt Romney to be a contender at the end, but did anybody expect Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, and Ron Paul to be the three not Mitts left standing at the end of January?
Josh, I don't think anybody would have predicted this outcome. I mean, the fact is, look, you are going to have to speak for Republicans and conservatives. As you know, I have no opinions. The reality is that Republicans are going to be left to decide whether their field of candidates, the ones who remain, are up to the task of defeating the president or of carrying the flag. But the reality is that, you know, a race where the two principal candidates who are likely to be nominees are Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich must not make many Republicans very happy, since both have such obvious shortcomings, and they may be enough of shortcomings to imperil what seemed only a few months ago like an extraordinarily good opportunity to dethrone the president. The fact is that if Gingrich is the nominee in the fall, he would be a terrific debater. He'd be a very, very feisty campaigner and competitor. But mm-hmm. we know the Gingrich story. It's not about the open marriage. It's about his open record. It's about the history that Gingrich has in politics of having been often at odds and at war with members of his own party on issues where he seems to tack from one side to the other. There are a lot of people who have served with him in the House over the years when he was Speaker and before he was Speaker who took great issue with his leadership style and would probably quarrel with this notion that he would be able to serve as president effectively, bring people together and run an efficient and successful White House and administration.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, look, Gingrich is a very problem. I would have to imagine that for conservatives, Gingrich is a very problematic candidate as a from an ideological standpoint and from a practical standpoint. On the other hand, what Romney has done to botch the discussion of his income taxes and his net worth over the last couple of days is breathtaking to me. The idea that somehow he didn't know he'd be asked about this, and that the second or third or fourth or fifth time that he was asked about this, that he did not have an adequate answer, just shows either a candidate who is completely incapable of playing at this level or staffing that is completely incapable of playing at this level. But in any case, it ought to give, I think, probably Republicans concern about whether Romney is up to the task of going against the president in the fall. The electability wreath that's been put on Romney's head up to this point notwithstanding, I think that over the last couple of days, a lot of Republicans who are looking at Romney as the potential nominee have got to be very nervous about whether he can do it. And honestly, I want to know what's in his tax returns. I mean, what could possibly be on Romney's tax returns that would cause him to be so reluctant to put them out? If he's simply standing on ceremony and there's nothing in there that's harmful to him, he's creating a whole bunch of fuss and concern and anxiety for nothing. If there is something in there, as Gingrich himself said over the last 24 hours, better to have it out now than to have it yeah. out in the fall when he's the nominee, if he's the nominee. I mean, I must believe that for someone like you, Josh, and for the people who think about the world as you do, the prospect of either Romney or Gingrich against Obama must be troubling to you.
Well, I will say that that with this particular field, the president's reelection chances have likely gone up. Look, all the president needs well, not all the president needs, but one of the major thing that the president needs for reelection is an upward trend. Things don't have to be going well. In fact, they likely won't be going well. But they need to be improving, and the public needs to perceive it as improving. So if there's an upward trend in unemployment, as I believe there has been a slight upward trend in unemployment nationally, and if you know, even South Carolina officials recently are talking about they expect 2012 to be a growth year for them, I guess the first one in several years. As long as that's happening and as long as it's perceived by the end of the year, the president's in a pretty good spot. You know, barring any major gaffes, he's got to be perceived as having an advantage. And add into the reality that he will likely raise and, you know, maybe even spend a cool $1 billion by the time Election Day in November rolls around. I mean, this is going to be the largest, fiscally speaking, this is going to be the largest campaign in American history. And no stone's going to be unturned. So you have to look at it as a very, very formidable re-election effort, regardless of who is opposing him. Now, on Romney, I'm also very interested in the tax return dodge. I don't feel particularly strongly about seeing Mitt Romney's tax returns one way or the other.
You don't feel strongly about Romney's tax returns, really? I think that's interesting. You don't think that Romney is obligated at this point to put his tax returns out just simply to quiet people from talking about that, as opposed to Obama? I mean, Romney has been thrown off of what has been a fairly disciplined effort to make the focus of this not on the Republican primary even, but on Obama and the general. And yet, for the last couple of days, really what he's talking about largely is why he's not releasing
the tax returns. Well, no, exactly, and that's what I was going to follow up with. I mean, I'm not interested in the tax returns as such. I'm interested in why he doesn't want to release them. I mean, that's what's interesting. I mean, I don't think anybody has any reason, unless you know something I don't, you know, to believe that there's anything particularly surprising in Mitt Romney's tax returns. I mean, I imagine like a lot of fantastically wealthy individuals and savvy entrepreneurs, he's probably got through various legal methods, you know, stashed in. I guess the Cayman Islands has come up and I'm sure various havens, which frankly, if I had hundreds of millions of dollars to my name, after buying a Toyota Tundra, I'd probably do that. So, you know, I don't think there's anything surprising there, but it is the reluctance to do so, coupled with the as you note, the incoherence and the bafflement in his responses to the request to do so. He would have been better
and the awkwardness, simply saying no. Yeah, and the awkwardness of his responses. He seems completely ill at ease talking about his wealth. And the problem for him, especially in this election year, I mean, you and I probably agree more about the success of the Occupy movement, which is to say, I think we both probably think it's not nearly been as successful as members of the Occupy movement think it's been. But the country has moved to at least entertain a discussion of inequality, whether it's 1%, 99%, or whatever else. Recall that this comes at the end of a several-year period in which there's a lot of hate on the Wall Street banks and other wealth creators for gaming the system for their benefit and to the detriment of everybody else. And Obama weirdly finds himself, if Romney's the nominee, running against someone who, if not literally, then at least perceptively, sets up as the embodiment of that whole culture of what your friend Rick Perry referred to as vulture capitalism, the idea that you're going to come in and make money off of money and that the losers in that are going to be the average person. Weirdly, Obama gets to run against Romney as the epitome of Wall Street and of everything wrong with the financial system. I mean, and Romney's refusing to talk about his own net worth or his own wealth in a way that is matter of fact and that defends the creation of wealth. And as he said a couple times, I think, you know, I'm not going to apologize for being successful. You know, if Romney just diffused this issue, it'd be one thing. But all he's doing is adding to what the president's going to have to attack in the general election, provided he's the nominee. And I can't believe, again, from a Republican perspective, that that's a good thing.
It is a bit shocking that Barack Obama, with the advisors that he picks from places like Citigroup and Goldman Sachs, et cetera, may have the opportunity to run against Wall Street and perhaps even win on that. I think you mentioned inequality and I think that's an issue more in maybe the offices of the New York Times and certain Occupy movement entities. I think what people are really upset about is not inequality per se, and not even against rich people per se. I mean, I don't see a lot of evidence that Americans hate that. I mean, Americans want to be rich. Like they don't hate the rich. They just want to be one of them, and they want to see that there's a path.
Right. Well, Josh, this is a very aspirational society, and actually, to some degree, Romney could turn that to his advantage and say, look, you know, I was able to with some help from my dad, but primarily on my own,
yeah.
I was able.
My father, the head of ANC Motors, right?
Romney has made a point of saying, you know, I didn't really inherit anything from my dad until after I was already wealthy on my own from the work I did at Bain. Now, Romney himself has set up a $100 million trust for his five sons. They're not going to have the same problems getting their start in life as Romney may say he had. But the reality is, it is an aspirational society. There's nothing wrong with wealth. There's nothing wrong with being rich. And there's nothing wrong, especially, with working hard and having the result of that hard work be some kind of a reward. And I can't figure out why Romney has not figured out how to pivot the discussion away from, I'm a rich guy, and we all hate rich guys in society now, and so I'm going to become the villain in this, to a thing about, mm-hmm. well, look, I worked hard, I got rich, you can too, and I want to create an opportunity society that allows everybody to have the same opportunity that I had to get rich. I mean, the fact is, he invokes Reagan a lot. Reagan was all about the opportunity society, and mm-hmm. and I can't figure out why he hasn't been able to artfully pivot over. Remember, he ran a very efficient and effective campaign, a disciplined campaign up to this point, and now that discipline has completely washed away, and it's just, I have to say, it's breathtaking to see, and it's created in the course of that an opening for a very flawed candidate in Gingrich to actually be competitive. As we said earlier, nobody would have predicted this at this point. We figured Rick Perry would be in this, and he's not. And instead, we have these two guys who both have very obvious flaws.
I think what it illustrates, though, is the extent to which maybe credit for his success, for his campaign success, isn't necessarily due to the campaign. I mean, I think there's a very good argument to be made, especially now with the way that things are going and looking like he's going to win South Carolina tomorrow, plausibly. It may have just been a very, very, very lucky campaign. And when I think back, especially over the past 6 months and the rise and fall of the various candidates, the only one that I think that you can really say that Romney or at least his surrogates had a hand in knocking off was pre-Iowa Newt. Like that's the one success. The rest of it was just this serendipity. And so I think there's an extent to which perhaps, and I don't have any inside information on the Romney campaign, but I do get the sense that they may have been seeing good luck and attributing it to themselves. And now, right. And I'll tell you what I think one of the moments is that they're still trying to figure out how to handle the Bain capital attacks. The Bain capital attacks were far more effective than I think a lot of people realize. You probably have seen the same polls that I have, but those things work they work in a place like South Carolina. They definitely work nationwide, and it's something that, of course, the president, if he faces Mitt Romney in the fall, it's gonna absolutely roll out on a massive scale. One of the models, I think, for looking at this campaign, you know, assuming that it's a Mitt versus Barack contest in the fall. This to me has been wonderful in explaining a lot. You remember the movie It's a Wonderful Life, right? And you've got George Bailey, the everyman, who's actually, frankly, a terrible businessman, but everybody loves him. I mean, he's a hero, you know, he's the ordinary guy, but he runs actually what looks like a pretty poorly managed savings and loan. And then you've got Henry Potter. Right. Who is the rapacious capitalist? And by the way, obviously Henry, in the middle of the film, he actually steals the money that I've forgotten the name of the barmy old uncle. But he's actually in fact a criminal. But
he was a crook. He's
a crook. But excluding that, nonetheless, but you already hate him by that point in the film. I mean, which is easily halfway to two thirds of the way through the film. But you hate him before that, even though he is a, you know, quote, legitimate businessman. And I think the contrast between Henry Potter, who everybody hates, and George Bailey, I mean, Barack Obama is going to position himself if he faces Mitt Romney. He's going to position himself as being on the George Bailey side of things. And
he'll run against a combination of Henry Potter and Gordon Gekko and the character on the Monopoly board with the top hat and the monocle, as John Heilman said yesterday on MSNBC. And again, this is a time when there's a lot of anxiety about the degree to which the financial institutions in this country have gamed the system. Legitimately or not, that anxiety exists. And, you know, whether – I actually disagree with you that the inequality discussion is more at home in the offices of the New York Times than the Occupy movement. It seems to me that what the Occupy movement is all about and has been all about is this idea that over the last 20 or so years, the rich have gotten richer and the poor have gotten poorer, that the gap between the rich and poor has widened, and it's been widening to some degree with the stamp of approval of the government, which has given breaks to the rich that have allowed them. I mean, I tell you what, one of the most extraordinary things to me this week was not Mitt's unwillingness to release his tax returns or even the fact that he had money in the Cayman Islands. I mean, I think there's something there's a sort of mystique to the Cayman Islands accounts that is not necessarily positive. I think people mm-hmm. don't fully appreciate what parking money offshore means, and I don't think the campaign did a terribly good job of saying, you know, yes, the money's there, but we're not using it as a tax haven. That's like saying she was dead when I got there, right, or something like
Indeed.
That. or I didn't inhale, you know. But to me, the more damning thing this week from a Romney perspective was that he said, I'm paying an effective tax rate of 15%. You know, there may be a perfectly legitimate reason for why that is. He's not being taxed on income. He's being taxed on capital gains, I guess, right? Or he's being taxed on investment capital. But the fact is, for the average person who's paying what he or she is paying in taxes in this country, the idea that someone with Mitt Romney's wealth is only paying 15% is from a perception standpoint, a terrible thing. It reinforces the idea that somehow the system is rigged for rich guys to not pay their fair share. And I mean, it may not be fair. Romney didn't do anything wrong here. He's simply playing by the rules as the rules are in place. And I think wasn't it George Bush George W. Bush, who was president, signed the law that caused that 15% tax to be the amount. I mean, isn't that a Bush? That's a Bush deal, I think. But in any case,
I don't know, but perhaps, yeah.
I think the fact that Romney is only paying 15% while he's done nothing wrong and he's following the law sets up from a perception standpoint as terrible. And it reinforces what will be the Obama line in the fall. I agree with you that you're running against – we're running against somebody who is an emblem of the problem.
It is possible for Romney on the 15% issue. I mean, it is possible for him in theory to turn that around and make the case that this is actually an argument for him, that he wants everybody in America to pay 15%. And, you know, if he's president, by gosh, he's gonna make that happen. But there seems to be the lack of realization that this is going to be an issue.
It's certainly not something he's going to want to brag about. He's not going to want to brag about the fact that he only pays 15%. He's not going to have a T-shirt made up that says, I am the 15% that he'll then wear on the campaign trail. I mean, the reality is he may be able to talk about it, and he may be able to argue why it's not as bad as it seems. But you know that from a perception standpoint, it's not going to be so great.
Listen, if I were able to figure out a way to pay 15% in taxes, I would absolutely wear a T-shirt.
Me too. But, you know, Gingrich putting out his tax return last night during the debate – a tax return that shows he paid an effective tax rate of 31%. I mean, again, the planets are aligning for Gingrich. I want to ask you a question now about this. It was, of course, Rick Perry, your candidate, who before he got out of the race was the loudest in attacking Romney for, quote, vulture capitalism, for the activities of Bain Capital that will ultimately now follow Romney, if he's the nominee, into the general election like toilet paper stuck to his shoe. And I want to know if you think Rick Perry screwed the pooch, as it were, for the Republicans by raising this issue and giving Obama the opportunity not to attack Romney himself, but to use clips of Republicans attacking Romney for this. Should Perry have kept his mouth shut on this?
No, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, let me separate this into two questions. I mean, was it a wise move for Perry to do it from a campaign standpoint? I think that's defensible because, again, the Bain attacks were having some effect in South Carolina, obviously not enough, or maybe they went to Newt instead. I actually don't think he's laid a landmine that wouldn't have been there in any case. I remember actually the first time that I heard about Bain Capital as a liability was over a year ago. I was on MSNBC, Network of Champions, with Jane Hampshire, and she started expostulating upon the evils of Bain Capital. I mean, I think this is an oppo thing that's been out there for quite some time. So look, you know, whether it's Republicans who bring it up or whether it's Democrats who bring it up, what's going to matter in the end, and certainly in a general election, is not – it's not going to be the clips. Americans aren't going to look at clips of Rick Perry or Newt Gingrich and say, that really sways me about Bain Capital. They're going to look at clips of whomever the president's reelection campaign digs up. Who's lost his job or been downsized or lost the family farm due to Bain Capital. That's what's going to be effective, and I think that was coming anyway. I don't think that's a landmine that Rick Perry laid that wasn't already there.
Did you see the Tampa newspaper yesterday had a story in the run-up to the Florida primary of a Florida business that Bain came in, took over, laid off a ton of people, and Bain made something like $240 million on the deal. It is those little landmines that will exist around the country. And if for all the Duane Reade's and Domino's Pizzas and Staples office supply chain that Romney names, the reality is there are still these other firms. Now, I heard Romney say in the debate last night, we created over the years, not just while he, Romney, was at Bain, but over the years since Romney has been there, about a net total of 120,000 jobs that wouldn't have existed had Bain not come in and cleaned up those companies, and that they only lost about 10,000 net jobs elsewhere around the country, so that it still is effectively more than 100,000 jobs. The specificity of those numbers, I guarantee you, will be picked over with, by a fine-tooth comb by the Obama Oppo team as well as by the press, because if they can give the lie to the idea that Bain's net job creation is anything approaching that, that's going to be another liability for Romney. And I would agree with you on the Perry thing in this respect. Bain's going to be out there regardless of whether Perry raised it. I actually do think it'll be interesting for Obama to be able to use Republicans' words against the Republican nominee. But there's even an argument, counterintuitive argument, that Perry did Romney a favor in inoculating him against this coming up in the fall for the first time before people. This gives Romney a chance to deal with it right now.
Yeah, I guess the question though is whether he's taking that chance. On a macro level, though, I mean, I have to say it's faintly. Although this is a real issue, and it's something that if Romney makes it to the nomination, he's going to have to deal with.
Yeah.
But it does seem faintly ridiculous, though, that we're talking about Bain Capital's record of job creation, job destruction, when the actual president of the United States has presided over some of the worst economic times since the Great Depression, on a scale far larger than anything that Bain did. And obviously, there's a difference between direct and indirect responsibility in these cases. But one would hope that if the nominee was somebody with a past at the likes of Bain Capital, for example, that he could make that case. And it's a case that we have to make, and it's something that he would have to go after the president on. And the guy who's doing that right now, though, and correct me if you correct me, but tell me if you disagree. I think it's not really Mitt. It's Rick Santorum and Newt, is it not?
It is Rick Santorum, I think, as much as anybody. I think there is some of Newt in there, but I think your choice of phrasing of this question is really interesting. You have a president who presided over, not a president who caused, not a president who lost, a president who presided over. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because as you and I talked about yesterday, walking down to get coffee, the country still
blames.
Oh, low
cover, quite after you.
The country, we actually see one another off computers. The country still blames Bush to a large degree for the state of the economy. They blame Bush for the economic decline in this country. So it's Obama inherited a certain amount of this from Bush, and the Obama campaign would argue, much as Romney argues that net-net he's created more jobs than he's lost, Obama will argue that they've actually done a hell of a lot of job creation over the last 3 years, and that the job losses that were put in motion because of what he inherited, and that but for Obama it would have been worse. You can always say that. I mean, I think one interesting aspect of that specifically is going to be that Romney opposed the bailout of General Motors. And Obama insisted that the government had to step in. And now General Motors, as of yesterday, is back to being the number one car maker in the world. GM has come back. And the Obama campaign will run on having saved Detroit when Romney would have let Detroit go bankrupt, especially ironic since his father's fortune and fame was the creation of his time as CEO of American Motors. I mean, there's a lot of ironies here. So.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned that Jim Messina, who's the head of Obama for America, or whatever the reelection effort is calling itself, was actually tweeting about that this morning, talking about the president investing in America by means of saving GM, which I guess, you know, I suppose if you're a GM competitor, be it Ford or a mom and pop shop that wants to get into auto manufacturing, I guess you're not really America in the Obama reelection effort. So I mean, he's done that. So I'll bring up another thing resulting from this no longer secret coffee rendezvous. I do think, and I'm curious what you think of this, that the historical model for this election is maybe, and of course this depends on the outcome, but it may be 1936. You know, and of course in 36 you had a Democratic incumbent who I think very plausibly actually made things far worse after getting in than when he found it. And but nevertheless, his Republican predecessor was still so reviled in the public memory for having presided over or even caused the beginning of the mess that he was able to leverage that into a fairly handy reelection in the fall. And I'm wondering if this is shaping up to be the template if the Republican loses in November, and it's still an if. You know, is it the fault of this Republican, or is it going to be the fault of the ghost of George W. Bush? I mean, that's very perplexing, and the data that we saw coming out this week hints toward an answer.
I don't think that if the Republicans lose this election that you can say that George W. Bush lost it any more than you can say George W. Bush lost the last election. I thought there was way too much emphasis put on the degree to which McCain was screwed from the beginning, because ultimately this was an Obama versus Bush election. John McCain lost that election as much as Barack Obama won it, because John McCain was a lousy candidate.
And
if the Republicans nominate the wrong person this time, against an incumbent who is not really even at 50% in his reelect number, then it will be the fault of the Republicans for nominating the wrong candidate. Now, I'm not saying that there was a right candidate out there. I mean, you can always say, well, somebody who's not running would have done better, and then they get in the race and you find out, as with Rick Perry. What were Rick Perry's numbers when he got in the race? They were a hell of a lot better than when he got out. And the fact is, if Mitch Daniels or Jeb Bush or Paul Ryan or Chris Christie or somebody who was on the sidelines were to somehow be drafted and get in this race, we might find out that the bloom comes off the rose just as quickly. But the reality is, whoever it is who runs against Obama, if the Republicans lose, the fault will not be on George W. Bush. The fault will be on that Republican and on the party for nominating the wrong person. The president is beatable. There are conditions at work that allow the president to be beaten. Doesn't mean the president will be beaten. And the reason he may not be beaten is, number one, he's a formidable campaigner. Number two, they have a lot of money in the bank. I think Republicans will have nearly as much. They'll certainly have enough. But the president has a lot of money. The third thing is, there is not personal antipathy toward the president, except in those quarters where people were never going to vote for the president for reelection anyway. But I think on the Republican side, there are quite a lot of Republicans who might be inclined to vote against Obama who actively dislike Newt or who actively dislike Romney and will say to pollsters openly, I could not vote for that person under any circumstances. I mean, that's a problem. You guys have candidates lining up who won't even win 100% of their party. And, you know,
well,
that's I have to believe that from your perspective, that's a problem.
Let me ask you this, and since we're almost at 40 minutes here, so I want to make this kind of the closing question.
Sure.
Of the four, and recognizing that you're not of that group, but making a call from the outside, if you had to advise the Republicans who to pick of the final four with the best chance of beating the president, who would it be?
Be Romney. And the reason is, even though Romney's a flawed candidate, I think that independents are more susceptible to the argument from Romney as opposed to Gingrich, that the president is a nice guy. He tried his best, but he wasn't up to the job, and it's time to try somebody new. Gingrich has so much baggage from his time in office previously and from his personal life that I think it's going to be very hard for a lot of independents and for a lot of suburban women, the kind of soccer moms we've heard about in previous elections, and quite frankly for a lot of evangelical women who I suspect will see Marianne Gingrich as more of a sympathetic figure than Newt would like to believe, whether the facts of that marriage are known to us or just known only to those two. I think that Romney sets up as a much better candidate with independents than Gingrich does. And I think that whoever wins this election will win it because independents will lean toward him as opposed to toward the other candidate. I still think Romney is a stronger candidate. I think that the choice for evangelicals, for Tea Party members, and for Southerners is going to be to put too many enough clothespins on their noses to vote for Romney. I really do. But I think Gingrich has the potential to run independents off and into the arms of President Obama, and I think that the states that Gingrich is weak in are states that Obama will need to get elected. I think that Romney has a chance to pick off states like Michigan and Ohio and Virginia, and I think Gingrich has a harder time doing that, and I think at the end of the day it comes down to the electoral map. So that's my long answer. Who is your preferred of the four? If you had to pick one, who would you put up against the president?
Well, I'm actually going to hedge here and say that Newt and Mitt likely both have pretty equitable chances. They have different weaknesses. I really approach the general election with this idea that for most of the electorate, these are going to be fresh faces, simply because people don't pay that much attention. I mean, you're completely right that Newt has a decades-long history in the public eye, certainly from the 90s. And there's substantive numbers of people who remember that. But for most of the electorate, it's going to be a fresh introduction. And so what you see in the campaign is going to be what you see. And Newt's done, to my mind, fairly well in that respect. Obviously, he's on the way to possibly winning South Carolina. I think one factor that can't be overlooked, and this may be, you know, two or three presidential elections too early for this to matter as much as I'm going to ascribe it to here. But if Newt is weaker among independents than Mitt is, on the flip side of that is that Newt is likely stronger among Hispanics than Mitt is. And so I'm not going to argue that independents and Hispanics are offsetting demographics in a national election, because they're not, but they will be at some point, likely. And of course there's overlap there too. I would argue that from a strategic perspective, that matters to the conservative movement a lot more than conservatives and Republicans may wish to think that it does. And so I wouldn't say that Newt's disadvantages are necessarily much more grave than Mitt's in general. Let me leave you with one final thought, then I'll let you have the last word, and then we will liberate the viewers from this. If it's a Newt versus Barack Obama contest, it will be the first election in American history, unless I'm misremembering something, it'll be the first election in American history where you've got two former faculty members, two college professors running against each other.
Yeah.
And the dynamic of that will, I think, be, if nothing else, massively entertaining. As anybody who's ever seen a faculty meeting knows, it will be knife fighting to the hilt and something to see. So last word for you.
I want to know who you think Newt would pick as his running mate.
Yeah, you know, that is a really, really good question. You know, if it's Mitt, I think today's endorsement from Bob McDonnell, Virginia governor, likely points to the type of person, if not the person, that he'll pick as his running mate. I think that the crown jewel of a running mate is likely somebody like Marco Rubio. Wouldn't surprise me if Newt went for somebody like that. It also wouldn't surprise me if Newt picked a guy like Luis Fortunio, who's the governor of Puerto Rico, you know, recipient of a laudatory Wall Street Journal column several months back.
Wow.
I think that
feels totally out of left field to me. That's a pretty
interesting choice. No, it's not actually. I'll send you the piece. Wall Street Journal had a great piece on Luis Fortunio, and so Republicans who have been involved in this sphere, which Newt has actually, have been talking about Fortunio for some time, and it would strike me as exactly the type of what does he like to say? Fundamental choice that would change the tone of the campaign. So we'll see.
All right. Well, I'll see you for coffee soon, Josh.
Very good. Evan, thank you so much for joining me.
All right. Take care.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye.